It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
They're goldfish.
Oh, yeah.
They're
goldfish.
Flavor blasted goldfish. Have you had blasted ones?
No, I haven't had goldfish at all for a long time.
I don't care for them. But the flavor blasted ones are better. Do you remember on Monday when I explained to you how it is you have not felt the pressure of peer pressure nearly as much, and it made you laugh for like 3 minutes straight?
Yeah, several times.
Yeah,
during the
and
day
you kept
too.
Elbowing me like, do you get it? As if I wasn't the one who said it. That was pretty funny.
It was funny. I think as funny as it was, though, I think it's only part of the answer.
Okay, it's funny. Do you remember then later when you wrote me a very sweet and nuanced thank you for taking you out to lunch, and I said, new phone, who this?
Yes, I remember that.
That joke is always never not funny. Anybody who texts me should be aware the more involved and serious your introductory text, the higher the likelihood I'm going to respond, new phone, who this? Because it's never not funny. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that started on Web 0.7 and has seen no need to update at all. You and your Web 1.0 fancy pants can eat an unblasted goldfish. This is the way. It got away from me a little bit there. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 641.
641. I'm going to turn you up a little bit because you are a quiet boy. For those of you just joining us, we have a hat. It's magic in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And all the peoples write in, except at the moment, I think we're down to exactly one. But people still write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with sort of whatever the crap they want. And then the hat magically transmogrifies, or transmog, as we like to say, the emails by forwarding them to us. We read them, talk about them. That's pretty much it. And somebody's been on week two of vacation. Not me. I'm on year three of vacation. So how's that been?
Well, you and I went out to lunch. That was really nice.
We did. Technically, I think we went out for breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And breakfast. I had comfortably the worst chicken and waffles I've ever had.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty sad.
IHOP now has chicken and waffles, and I should have known the red flag that they came with your choice of dipping sauce. It is just, I think, four of their chicken tenders on a plate sitting next to four of the saddest, limpest quarters of Belgian waffle you've ever seen. It was chicken, and it was also waffle. bare bones, never the twain shall meet. I made them sort of come together, but it was not very good. To be fair, it was still fine. Like, I haven't had a chicken and waffles that I'm like, ugh! Like, it was very much the worst chicken and waffles I've had. It was still perfectly edible and even tasty, but
okay.
It shames the name chicken and waffles. It does not shame the name IHOP. It's pretty on.
Yep.
On mark brand there. Yeah. But chicken waffles. Eh. Yeah. So what else? That was the only interesting thing that happened, I'm assuming.
Well, we played that game. I told you about it while we were at breakfast. That hunt a killer game.
You hunted a killer, except there wasn't a killer. And
no, this was what was different from the games we played before was there was a supernatural theme and it was a level 5 difficulty. The level 5 difficulty. I mean, I think I would like to play another level 5 game. I do like the challenge of it. It's not necessary for it to be, you know, fun or anything. Like the level 3 games we played are, I would say, fairly easy, but really fun. So I'll still play 3, 4, 5 difficulty.
Now, what you think you said is the increased difficulty isn't necessary in order for me to have fun with the game.
Yeah.
What came out of your mouth is... It isn't necessary to be fun.
No.
Making it sound like, I just want a hard game. I don't necessarily want to enjoy it.
No, it didn't make it more fun for it to be more difficult. I prefer a challenge just, you know, in general, really.
As an independent thing, yes.
Yeah, but I don't think it really overall increased the enjoyment to the point where, gosh, I can never play anything but a level 5 again because everything else is going to seem boring by comparison, you know. I think level 3 or 4 would be perfectly enjoyable. Maybe not as challenging, but perfectly enjoyable. Mostly because the world building and the character development stuff they do for these stories is pretty interesting and fun by itself. I mean, it almost makes me think I would like even a level 1 or 2 because it would still be fun for those reasons. But I'm pretty sure if it was too much easier than 3, it doesn't matter how interesting it is. It'd start to be a little too easy, too boring. But, and the supernatural theme was very interesting and fun, but it wasn't, as I told you, and as you already pointed out, there was no murder mystery. There was no killer. There was no mystery really of any kind, except you in general didn't know what was going on in the, you know, kind of like usual.
Like supernatural, real life for me.
Well, or like some supernatural stories, the only mystery is there are things happening and you don't know why.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a mystery in the sense of, oh, this thing happened and we need to find out why it happened and so on and so forth. Nope. It's just things are happening. Why did it happen? We don't know. And you, and as I explained to you earlier, you know, there's almost sort of a LARP aspect to this thing where in the hunter killer games where you're sort of pretending to be a detective or whatever. I mean, that's part of the fun. And in this one, you're not pretending to be a detective, really. You're pretending to be more of a like a paranormal investigator. And that's the kind of tasks you get is, oh, I think there's a voice on this recording. Can you decipher what it's saying or things of that nature? And again, that's also fun, but I didn't think as fun as the other stuff.
I've been watching a lot of paranormal investigation movies again recently, and I don't consider them fun at all.
Well,
I don't know why that would even be the word used.
So the other paranormal games they have, like two of them are based on Blair Witch. Like it's like licensed. They got a license to make a game based on Blair Witch. And in the first one of those, when I look at the synopsis, it talks about someone's missing. Now, see, that would be better, right? Someone's missing and you're trying to help them find that person. And there's still the supernatural theme. Whereas this one we played, nobody was missing. You weren't even like there was something that happened in the past that nobody knew why it happened, but that wasn't like by the second installment, you knew what happened. So that wasn't, you weren't trying to solve that mystery or anything. It was just things were happening and this person wrote you a letter to see if you could help them figure out very specific problems and puzzles that this person was dealing with. You weren't trying to solve some overarching thing, which again, that was fun, but it wasn't as fun, you know, as having a specific thing that you're trying to solve. And in the other ones that were episodic, there was a part of the puzzle you were solving each time and you were moving closer and closer to the end solution. Whereas in this, that was nothing like that. Each thing you did at the end of each episode was just, sometimes you weren't even solving any kind of problem. You were just sending a message to the person who was writing you. Her name was June. And I, you know, they must have some kind of artificial intelligence thing to spot keywords in what you type back, so they know if you got the right thing or said the right thing.
It's real. There's a lady named June.
Over to what I mean is, in the other one, you had to actually have an answer, right? Mm. In this one, sometimes you just had to describe something. Well, also in this one,
paying attention. So that's
also in this one, they wanted you to perform rituals. Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, we didn't do the rituals. I mean, you didn't have to do them to go through the thing. But I think they really wanted, if you're really getting into the game, that you would like perform these rituals.
Did you order this one on the website, or was this like in a van near your house? Like,
yeah, it was weird.
This sounds like the first two panels of a Chick Tract. And I'm worried that you're going to die and then we're going to have a quote about how fucking around with subscription box mysteries are Satan's gateway or something.
It was still fun. It just wasn't what we expected. And, you know, I think if we do supernatural,
it's because it didn't come from me is why it wasn't as fun.
If we do supernatural games from them in the future, we're going to really kind of look into it and make sure that it's maybe a little different. It was still fine. And we had some technical difficulties with it, as I told you.
Yes.
And that continued to be a real problem. We finished the game, but the technical problems at the end kind of did spoil the experience a little bit, but I don't want to blame the game on that. You know, that was just a technical thing. If they fix it,
5G.
I'm sure it'll be fine. But yeah, it was fine. I think the next one we'll try is a level 5 difficulty, but it's set in a science fiction setting.
Mm.
But I think it's unlike this, where it being supernatural changed the whole everything about the game. In this case, it's in a science fiction setting, but it's still a, you know, murder mystery or whatever. So,
dude, just sanitation workers. You just come in each day, and
we really liked. Nice. We really liked the other episode one we did was from a theater owner, and the murder was something that happened like, you know, 80 years before or something. That was really interesting.
And you managed to bring the murderer to justice. That's impressive.
That was really interesting.
You finally caught me. I was two when I killed that man.
No, nobody was still alive from that. But
I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you eventual whippersnappers.
But you really got a sense of place with that one. Like the theater really, you know, you really kind of got, you almost wished it existed so you go visit it. That's how well done it was. And I was kind of hoping that this one would be the same because it was in West Virginia, a mining community and stuff. And they worked in a lot of interesting cultural and linguistic things into the game, which I thought were very clever and very interesting.
A lot of clean coal propaganda.
But it didn't quite reach that level because, I don't know, not what we were expecting, I guess. I'm glad we got it. I'm glad we played it. But But I think next time we get a supernatural themed one, we'll pay more attention to what sort of the plot is and make sure it's something that we think we'll be interested in. But, I mean, that it took a lot of time. I mean, that's, it was a, I think maybe partly because it was a level 5 difficulty, the each episode took a very long time. So it was, we did it over a couple, like 3 evenings. I mean, it was a lot.
Sounds awful. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
We have a, so for a long time, I've wanted a magnetic marker board so that I can,
mark?
No, sometimes when I'm doing work, not just homework either, but like academic work, it helps me to visualize things. And I'll write on paper, or I'll write on like a open paint or something, and it's just not as good. You know, it doesn't flow, or I'll lose the piece of paper or whatever. So I've always thought, man, it'd be so nice to have a marker board that I can just sort of, you know,
yeah,
write out or draw my thoughts or whatever. So, and Abby thought that would be good for these games. We'd have a murder board or whatever. So she got one, and we've got one in the living room now. And we used it for this game, which was, and it was really handy. I cannot believe how handy it was.
I like having them around. I've used them in every work environment I've had. And yeah, I still got some around here. They can be very handy. They can be really handy for gaming. They can be really handy for a lot of things.
Yeah. So, but this is a big one. I mean, it's, if it were behind me, you wouldn't be able to see the whole thing. It would just be white behind me. That's how big it is. And
that might be crazy, but okay.
But so yeah, that's really cool. We have, I don't know where we're going to put it though. I think it's going to come be in this office eventually, but we don't have, I mean, if you could see the rest of this office, it's
full. It'll of go things. Behind you, and every week you'll write what number episode on is on it.
Maybe. I mean, right now it wouldn't fit behind me, but I mean, I think we're going to rearrange things so that maybe it could, but yeah, it's really cool, and I'm glad we have it, and I'm going to be using it a lot, and Abby's probably going to think I'm crazy with some of the cryptic things that
continue
are on it,
to think you're crazy, but all right.
I don't know. It just helps me think, you know,
besides not doing rituals for 3 nights and having breakfast with me, did you do anything else?
No, I don't think so.
That's good.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Time off. No, you need time off. It's important. You should be not doing things.
Okay.
In what fact, else did let's you do? Just, let's just sit here for a minute, not do things.
Okay.
Very nice. Sorry, what were you saying?
Oh, I asked you about your week.
Oh, let's find out.
And while you're talking about it, I'll continue to not do things.
I don't think there's long enough here. Oh, I did invent a life hack. And if you've heard rumors that I came up with while I was high, they are false. If you are someone who has difficulty admitting when you are wrong and saying when you are sorry, maybe you should practice by saying you are sorry and apologizing to your pets when no one is home.
Because
they don't understand you anyway. So you're mostly just talking to yourself. There you go. You're welcome.
I'll have to give that one some thought.
To your pets. Like I said, if you were under any sort of impression that I came up with that while high, it is not true.
I mean, I'm just thinking that you could, that could be applied to other things that you don't think you can do, or you don't have confidence. True. You know,
can't do something? Do it to your pet, because what are they going to do? Complain?
I mean, if it's a sentiment expressing verbally or whatever.
Yes, this is true.
Like,
don't want a therapist? Talk to your cat.
You don't think you're good at complimenting people, or you don't think you're good at being gracious towards people. You know, you could practice on your pets, maybe.
I think I am good at being gracious towards people. I think I am not good at being gracious towards pets. So maybe it's the opposite. Maybe the people in my life, I need to like scritch them behind the ear. You good. Yeah, you good boy.
Wait, I was going to do nothing. I got to get back to doing nothing. Okay. Continue.
We are watching, well, we're watching 4 seasons of Atlanta, which is still absolutely wild. And we're also watching High Desert on Apple TV Plus.
Oh, with
Patricia Arquette.
Patricia Arquette. Mm-hmm.
Patricia Arquette and Bernadette Peters and Brad Garrett in a fairly involved ensemble cast already.
Bernadette Peters is in it?
Bernadette Peters is in it.
Jeez.
In a very weird capacity that is very difficult to explain without spoiling things. And Matt Dillon has a recurring role in it.
Oh, yeah.
Matt Dillon is somebody that literally, when I first knew of him, I did not like him. And with every passing year and new project, I dislike him a little bit less. And he is now at the point in his career where I kind of like him a lot. I like him when he's older and more mature. But Patricia Arquette is fabulous, and Bernadette Peters is Bernadette Peters, so who the fuck cares how she is? She's Bernadette Peters.
She is something else.
It's only 8 episodes, which is, I started off in love with, I'm a sucker for older lady protagonist. I think it's why I like Golden Girls and everything like that, and Patricia Arquette is really leaning into the older lady protagonist here. She is, however, kind of a piece of shit. And she's one of those fast talkers who just fills up the space with lies until she kind of gets what she wants. And so my sympathy for that is dropping episode to episode. She's a very sympathetic character in many ways, but in my opinion, she acts worse every time. And so it's stretching it, but it's definitely not a boring show, and there's all sorts of, it's a lot of weird hijinks of, you know, people blackmailing people, and people have stolen merchandise, and somebody almost got killed or maybe did get killed for things, and it's ostensibly her being a private eye in Palm Springs, but it's more accurately her convincing a private eye to let her be an unpaid intern in Palm Springs.
But I mean, Patricia Arquette is, I think she's very charismatic, and she's just
absolutely, to me, she's, absolutely.
It almost, I think, doesn't,
if it
matter
wasn't
what
her, I probably would give up on the show real quick.
Yeah, that's what I was going to kind of get at. Like, I wonder if, because it's her and she's so charismatic and she's so compelling to watch, that even though she's a character you normally wouldn't like, you can still watch it.
And she just embodies the character, feels so real. And I think in some ways that helps. Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of shows that's like, yeah, that's a ridiculously terrible character. I'm like, no, I could see this person. And this person is coming from a rough place and a place of desperation. But I'm still hung up since I was a child on issues of fairness and honesty and things, even though I'm incredibly unfair and I lie constantly. So when I see too much of that in a character, I have trouble with it, but I'm still enjoying it. I still think I would even recommend it. I think it's good that it's just 8 episodes. And then a couple movies. We saw, and neither of us can remember if we ever saw it before, but if we did, it was a very long time ago. The original Total Recall.
Mm.
The Schwarzenegger one.
Hmm. It doesn't really hold up, does it?
Yes and no. It is very generic 80s action movie in a way that none of them hold up. I'm surprised at how well the effects hold up. They don't hold up perfectly, But given how old it is, I am kind of impressed with a lot of the effects. Maybe it's just because you don't ever see anything anymore that's solidly practical. And that may be part of it. But I had an okay time. I had a good time watching it. It's not amazing, but it's me, so I really, really enjoy seeing very young versions of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sharon Stone and Michael Ironside. It's Michael Ironside's back when you could reasonably call him young, which I forgot that existed. Young, villainous Ronnie Cox. Just a lot of good faces in it. But yeah, I was okay with it. It's not mind blowing, but. And then last night, we watched on Max a documentary, Being Mary Tyler Moore. I believe I would highly recommend it. It's another one of those where I'm like, I don't know how much credit I want to give to it as a documentary. But the material they're working with is fascinating. It definitely gave me, there were no jaw-dropping surprises, but it gave me a better depth of perception on Mary Tyler Moore. And it's also full of a lot of like home video things of like the price of admission alone is worth it for somebody doing a home video of her bridal shower. And they're all just in PJs and smoking cigarettes in, I think, her living room. And people are coming up and giving little speeches and stuff, including Betty White, who's just hanging out there because, of course, they knew each other from back in the day doing the Mary Tyler Moore show and all that. It's clearly been put together for a long time. It's one of those documentaries that doesn't do face-to-face interviews. It's all footage and voiceover, and they keep telling you which voice it is, but a lot of the voices are people who I know to be dead now. So I think they've been putting this together for a while. And it is interesting who they have and who they don't in terms of the sort of voiceover stuff. Her husband, when she died, was one of the executive producers I saw at the end. And it's a pretty solid birth to death documentary. So I learned a lot and I found it very interesting and it has a lot of cool footage. I don't know that I give it a lot of credit for its skill as a documentary. I'm sorry, Ezzy. See? Practice. And she forgives me. But yeah, I thought it was very, in my head, I think part of me has always thought of Mary Tyler Moore as a bit of a stereotype for the time period where she was big. And now I'm like, no, she was the archetype for the time period she was in. And there is a lot of really interesting stuff revolving around her personal politics versus her public politics. Like, She never identified as a feminist, and yet her whole life and career is full of a whole bunch of major feminist milestones, especially in show business. And she was supportive to that cause. Like, her whole relationship with the concept was very complicated at places. And she's another one of those who like had a long enough life and a long enough career that like she went through such huge phases in like who she was and who she found out who she was. So I think it's very interesting, and it's on Max. And if you don't have Max, it's one of the better streaming services out there right now. So I would recommend checking it out. All right. It's email time. Ezzy, get on it. Okay, she's on break. William, please go read our email. I believe the last email we have, so the podcast is probably done.
Subject line says, "The Classics."
It's from Who's Jazz. This from it's jazz. Jazz. We've had a jazz era lately.
She says, As folks well-versed in therapy, I was wondering what y'all think of the theories of the classic trio Adler, Freud, and Jung. Still useful today? Yours in head shrunkenness. The better to wear a hat, my dear, Jasp.
All right. William's going to have more to say on this than any of us are going to want to hear. I'm going to stop the podcast. He's going to keep going. So before he gets in there, I would just say Adler, Freud, and Jung, I would say their first three studio albums. After then, it got a little poppy for me. But overall, I mean, it's like the Beatles. I acknowledge their accomplishments. It doesn't do it for me now. I feel like people.
It's when they let Pepsi use one of their songs in a commercial that they lost me.
Right. I feel like that was, I mean, they were all dead. It's not like, but yeah.
Still, it was selling out, you know.
Yeah, no, I get it. Holographic Jung was very problematic.
I mean, it was cool, but not worth it.
All right, you go.
Oh, I go. Okay, well.
You're the one who has an actual answer.
I do, sure. So it's very easy to find people who are students of Adler, Freud, Adler, or Jung today. And you can go visit them for therapy. And I presume that people who go are many times satisfied. So, you know, the practical answer to the question still useful today is, well, yes, because these practitioners still exist and they presumably are being successful.
I want to pause there. So there are real, like, non-fringe therapists who are very, like, practically and publicly largely base their work around Freud, who have career success.
Sure. Yeah.
I thought Freud was pretty well consensus as full of like Aristotle, like had some great ideas for the time, but pretty much we've gone beyond all of that bullshit since then.
Well, Adler and Jung were students of Freud's, of course, and they departed from him on some key issues, but a Freudian today. Okay. So a Freudian today
walks into a bar,
would have some of the same ideas and approaches as an Adlerian or a Jungian, in that the unconscious is a thing. The unconscious has a influence on people that they don't have a lot of control over. The bigger problems that a person has psychologically are going to be because of something the unconscious is doing. They're probably going to have concepts. Of the person's past is probably going to be important. And symbolism in whatever they're thinking or dealing with is probably important. All of these things are things that all of those three are going to have somewhat in common. And those are big things. Those are very important, because not all therapists believe those things. There's some therapists that, even if they believe the unconscious exists, because most brain and mind theorists do believe that there's lots of things going on that you're not conscious of. A lot of therapists don't think that the unconscious, well, for example, Aaron Beck was a follower of Freud, and he was clinically testing some Freudian concepts, and they weren't proving out in clinical tests. And then with some of his clients, he just addressed their thinking, like what their habits of thinking or their automatic thinking was in the moment. And he was helping them that way. And so he concluded, you don't need to worry about what's going on in a person's unconscious or in their past. You just need to address their thoughts. And their thoughts are going to be what's causing them problems. You challenge their thoughts, you help them correct their flaws in thinking, and they'll get better. And the approach that he sort of founded, cognitive therapy, and now it's cognitive behavioral therapy, which it became cognitive behavioral therapy in his lifetime, because he only passed away a couple of years ago. But that's like the most clinically tested approach and successful for just about everything, CBT. So that means some people think that means that, you know, that's what discredits Freud more than anything, not the fact that he had weird ideas about human sexuality and stuff, but that his ideas about the unconscious weren't really relevant to therapy. All you had to do is address a person's here and now problems of thinking, you know?
Okay.
So
you've just given me the great historical context and argument for why there absolutely shouldn't be Freudians still practicing today.
Well,
and if they are, they should be considered the freaks on the fringe that none of the other therapists like to play with.
But the thing is, CBT doesn't help everybody. I mean, there are people.
It's the entourage effect. You need different cannabinoids all together, and then I'm aware.
Now, there are some people who would still consider themselves Freudians. Not just because of the whole unconscious stuff, because again, Adlerians and Jungians subscribe to that too. And there are people that would call themselves neo-Freudians, which are mostly just people who subscribe to everything Freud had to say, except for the sex stuff. But there are some people who would say, no, I'm a Freudian, and they might change a little bit their views on things like penis envy and things like that, but they'd still adhere to the ideas of the developmental phases, right? The oral phase, the anal phase, the genital phase, and so on. Slightly corrected for more recent clinical findings, but to them, Freud was wrong about some things, but so was Beck, so was Rogers, so was a lot of other people. You know, you tweak things and adjust things as clinical knowledge comes out. But they think otherwise. Freud was on the right track, and they are Freud. They call themselves Freudians. They don't. I mean, that they bill themselves as that. People come to them for help, and they get help.
Are there people who are prominent alienists? Back in the day, who are now widely considered just straight up bullshit?
Well, you can find plenty of people who say that about Freud. Yeah,
I know. But is there anyone in history that the modern therapy consensus is large? Like, very few people believe any of their shit anymore.
Well, I mean, the only person I can think of, because the thing about that question is that if there are, I wouldn't have been told about them. Really? No. Right?
However, you're you. So if there are, the odds of you, you know, when you were taking a break from your schoolwork to look up
one.
Completely wiped off the map, therapy founding parents.
I can think of one.
All right.
And that's Franz Mesmer, because he thought that there was like actual magnetism between human beings, right? Mm. And if you manipulated the magnetic fields, you could affect a person's health. Of course, you know, he ended up using something that later people developed into hypnosis. So he was, and that's where we get the word mesmerism, you know, to mesmerize someone, or mesmerism comes from him. You know, aside from the practice of hypnosis, which was developed based on some of his stuff, I don't think none of his theories or practices, or I mean, nobody practices anything even remotely related to Franz Mesmer, except for hypnosis, which I don't think he invented that, you know. So like, nobody who does hypnotherapy thinks of themselves as a student of Mesmer. I don't think so. He's one that is just totally off of the board, really. He's the only one, I think. Now, Adler was, he emphasized social connections and you know, birth order, yes, and, you know, family influences and things like that.
I hate social connections.
So that I like that about Adler, that he seemed to understand how a person's social interactions have a lot to do. Because he really, the big, there's a lot of disagreements between Adler and Freud and Jung and Freud, but a lot of it has to do with, you know, drives, like what, you know, what drives human beings, or are there drives in the first place, right? Can we narrow things down to drives?
I own a car, so.
Well, I mean, like, you know, sex drives or.
Oh, no, that doesn't exist.
The death drive or whatever. And for Adler to pick up on.
I played bass for Death Drive in the late 90s.
For Adler to pick up on social interactions, I mean, I think he was one of the first well-known, you know, thinkers to do that. I mean, anyone in psychology or counseling or even psychiatry, I think, when they want to think of the person who introduced social interaction as an important part of human psychology, they're going to talk about Adler probably.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know if he was really the first, but that's what the profession says is the first. Jung, you know, eventually emphasized broader themes, you know, like spiritual themes and religious themes and things like that. And, you know, a lot of people who think spirituality is an inherent part of therapy or is, you know, it's going to be an inherent part of therapy, look at Jung. In fact, even existential therapists are finding that, you know, back in Jung's day, he didn't consider himself an existentialist and he was critical of existentialists. But the fact of the matter is there's in the Venn diagrams, I mean, there's a guy wrote an article about this, a really, really good article about this, as a matter of fact. In the Venn diagrams between Jung and existentialism, there's a lot of overlap.
Well, that's because he did a lot of, I mean, off and on collaborative work, right? He worked with Crosby, Stills, and Nash often. And that's when they were Crosby, Stills, Nash,
I mean, people forget that Jung was a studio musician for a really long time. He's, if you look at album covers, you'll see his name on there a lot of times. People don't
know. Right? Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Jung.
Plus, he did cover art sometimes. A lot of people don't know that.
I'm very proud.
He did cover art. He did Boston's cover art. People don't know that. Anyway.
I did. I didn't know that. Okay. Now you have an assignment for next week. You have to do the Spaceship Boston cover and you have to analyze it from a Jungian perspective.
Well, it was one of the members of the band had a dream about that. And so,
I mean, this is absolutely here's how I'll spend my last week of vacation, William, kind of thing right there. Is take that album cover and.
See, this article I'm talking about, this is an existentialist therapist. He says that he proposes an existentialist perspective to therapy that is also depth psychology, right? A marriage between existentialist approaches and Jung, which means, and this article is only like 2 years old. So the question of, well, is Jung still useful or relevant? Well, apparently, you know, people are still writing articles where they're incorporating some of Jung's ideas.
There you go. There it is, Jazz. You got Jung'd.
But Adler, too.
And apparently Freuded and addled.
Because Adler, like I said, Adler's
I mean, Adler still has a lot of friends. All the addle heads, sound off in the comments.
His understanding that interpersonal interaction is a huge, even foundational aspect of human behavior and nature. He was correct about that. I mean, I, coming from a sociological background and a symbolic interaction background, really appreciate that Adler did that. I don't think he went far enough, but, you know, certainly if I write, and I've written things about symbolic interaction in some of my papers, and it's helped that I can reference people like Adler and other thinkers who are pulling in social interaction as an important part of human psychology. And it helps bolster some of my arguments for a school of thought that most therapists don't know anything about.
You think if I had been raised in an alley by some stray cats, I could be a cat now?
No.
Not like physically, but
No.
Sounds nice.
Sorry.
This is my counterpoint to all of your technical talk. What if I was a cat? Could I be a cat?
It's funny she's asking this question because while I was in St. Charles, Illinois, Chicago there was one of my fellow students sort of addressed to the rest of the group how important and influential Freud was and how they, you know, a lot of modern instruction in therapy doesn't give him a lot of credit. Like, you know, 90% of what you talk about when you're talking about therapeutic approaches and everything makes reference to concepts that Freud really popularized. And, you know, a lot of people just think, oh, Freud was a misogynist and he had these weird ideas about sex and stuff.
Yeah, no,
and,
I'm shocked. I mean, I'm not showing it because I hate you to think that anything you say I think is interesting, but I am very surprised to learn this. It's funny. I think that the same pop psychological background I have, that is the one that uses Freudian concepts still, is also the one that says, but yeah, it's all bullshit. Freud is like astrology at this point. So yeah, I find it really interesting to learn that these folks are still considered widely influential.
Well, I mean, I think the unconscious is a thing. I think it does things to people. I think there's such a thing as defense mechanisms and complexes.
Yeah,
and I think
you keep telling me how bad I want to sleep with my mom and kill my dad. And I'm like, first of all, rude. Second of all, wrong. Third of all, my dad is dead. So extra rude, William. Is what I say. Almost every time we're not on recording, he talks about this.
You know, 25 years ago when I was taking those classes in counseling psychology, we had to do a paper on a theoretical orientation. And I don't know why, but I thought, I'll see what I can do with some of Freud's original ideas. And someone had done a study on... I think I probably talked to you about this before. Maybe I talked about it on the podcast before. Someone had done a study on toilet training in various cultures around the world. Lots of cultures. I mean, and it was a good cross-cultural.
So much baby poop.
It was a good cross-cultural study too, because a lot of times someone says, oh, well, we did a cross-cultural study and it's the United States, Canada, Spain. it's like North American and European countries. Yep. That's hardly a cross-cultural thing. No, this one did. It went all over and it had tribal hunter-gatherer cultures, all kinds of groups and all kinds of practices. So on one extreme, you had a group that they would carry their children around without any kind of diaper type apparatus. And if the kid did something, they just, made a mess and then they cleaned it up and that was it. I mean, there was no toilet training at all. Just somehow the kid picked it up, just like they pick up language or other cultural practices or whatever. There was no discernible toilet training at all. And on the other extreme, they had, I think it was Japan actually, where there was some very, at this time, this study was done, some very strict punitive toilet training.
Chinese babies are enclosed in what you call a zorb, and they just hose it out periodically. Don't let anything touch the outside.
Anyway, the study wanted to know if fitting in with Freudian.
Anybody gave a shit?
Nice.
Sorry, no pun intended. That was not the joke I was trying to make.
Oh,
I'm just saying, we all realize that everybody eventually figures out how to fucking poop, and we should
chill. The question was: what is there? Is there an impact, cultural impact, from that? Right? Like, what is the? Is there a correlation between what the larger culture is like in terms of things like neatness in terms of things like, I don't know, how you respect or interact with authority, other ways that society is structured. Mm-hmm. And they thought there was a correlation. They thought they saw a Freudian confirming correlation between, and they didn't know which way the causal thing went, right? Like when you have a non-hierarchical, highly egalitarian, not really concerned about the rules culture, then they don't care about toilet training. Or because they don't care about toilet training, they have that kind of culture. But there was a correlation between those two things, where toilet training or lack thereof seemed to be highly correlated with the way the culture approached things like hierarchies, authority, rules, cleanliness, neatness. You know, a lot of the characteristics you would call anal retentive, quote unquote, you know, the highly regimented and punitive cultures for toilet training were, quote unquote,
more like anal retentive, retain their own anuses.
and the ones on the other extreme were less so. That's kind of interesting.
As they say in the great song, in the one musical episode of Scrubs, everything comes down to poop. I assume that was the title of the paper that they wrote on the subject.
I don't remember what the title was. I thought it was pretty interesting because at that time, I was, how old was I? You know, 28, 20, whatever. That was a time in my life where certainly I thought there wasn't much to learn from Freud. I mean, specific things like the unconscious and all that. Yeah, good for you, Freud. But then, you know, Adler and Jung and so many other people did so many better things with those basic concepts. You know, I just thought, who cares about Freud? But for whatever reason at that time, I was interested to know is anyone today, because this was a recent article at the time, is anyone today even thinking about this or finding out or examining this? And this was one of the things that I found, and I thought it was actually pretty interesting. Maybe today it's been found to be total BS or something. I have no idea, but the time was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it does get very interesting because you want to break down. So a concept in my classes late in my degree was playing around with the concept of liminality. Mm. And it's often just very much, again, another sort of us and them, and it's letting people. Rumspringa with the Amish is a great example, putting people in a situation where they get to be separate from what would be the normal situation there. And there's a lot of cultural institutions like that are tied very strongly to biological processes. The most famous ones being things involving childbirth and menstruation in frequently very problematic ways. But so it makes me wonder, because when you describe this at first, I'm like, well, obviously, I mean, we're talking about hygiene and cleanliness issues and all this. And as you do in your bathroom, why would you not do out in the world or whatever, at least on basic principle? But then I'm like, no. We're talking about potentially social norms and beliefs that we attach to the concepts of cleanliness and hygiene, but that have nothing to do with that on any sort of physical or biological level.
Right. Not necessarily. You're right.
Neatness and getting all the poop off of your butt aren't necessarily parallel things. I mean,
I
can see how one lends itself to the other, but they don't necessarily go together. But it's very counterintuitive in my head because, of course, I was born into, you know, the world and raised by the people. I hear, I have not confirmed, but I hear it took a village.
Oh. A whole village. For you, I can believe it.
Is that a fat joke?
No.
We couldn't get him out of the crib. We had to call the neighbors. We had to do one of those, like, okay, oh on God. Three, not three and go, but on three, we're all going to lift. That was a very big
What's
baby.
What's wrong with you? Yeah, so.
Just this morning, I don't even remember what it was now, but it was something that we were talking about me buying, and it was dumb or whatever. And I was like, well, I bought it with my money. And Trish is like, but that's just the thing. It's all my money. And I was like, how dare you? We have worked really hard to maintain this illusion here. How dare you just call me out like that? I was like, we've got this whole thing of like mutual. How dare you expose our carefully constructed illusions? And then she tried to give me some cash, and I was like, that just makes me feel cheap.
Which you didn't mind, really.
I did say at the end, she came over and kissed me goodbye, and I was like, okay, give me that.
Well, another part of Jazz's question is a question: are there problems are there problems or clients that are such that you need to dig into their past? You need to examine their unconscious or whatever. And a lot of therapists today think, well, sure there are. Sometimes you have clients who they just want to do that. That's just where they want to go, and you need to really follow where the client goes. But also there are problems that they relate to their past. They relate to something that happened back then. There's unconscious things that you're just going to have to dig up. So there are some people that won't be helped by cognitive behavioral therapy because their problem or their personality aren't going to allow that kind of approach. You're going to have to take what's often called a psychodynamic or approach or an Adlerian approach and dig into their past or their family or what have you to figure it out. So yeah, it's still useful for those problems.
Very much of two minds about that. Because on the one hand, I know the value firsthand of digging into my past and seeing what has happened and how that has affected me. And often knowing that has allowed me to get a good perspective on my life now. Like, oh, I feel this way because of this stuff that happened. And once I'm aware of that, then I can make the changes I need to or accept what I need to or adjust accordingly. On the other hand, a lot of my last in therapy, which was like about a year and a half, was a lot of learning, figuring out where the why of it isn't a solution. It has the potential to aid in a solution, but it in and of itself is not a solution. And if you can find a solution without having to do that, that's better than the opposite.
Yep.
Like, figuring out the why is no good if you still don't figure out what to do about it. And if you can figure out what to do about it, the why mostly becomes academic.
Yeah, that's one of the things that made people move away from psychodynamic or psychoanalytic theories altogether, like not even be interested in doing anything close to it, is this expression that you'll hear therapists sometimes say is insight isn't enough. Because insight, that's one of the things that psychoanalysis, psychotherapy is supposed to, you know, give a person insight. And the idea is that, like you were just talking about, once the person has insight, it'll solve everything. Well, that's just not the case for most things. So,
I mean, sometimes
and,
it has helped me a lot.
Sure,
I've had some genuine epiphanies about my past that have like completely changed my view of my life. And it's been great. But I've also had several things, especially now, and I think it's coming with age and all of this, where I'm like, I'm tired. I've been spending forever trying to figure out why. When I stopped doing that and started focusing on what do I do about it, it got better faster.
Yeah.
Because it was just observational data. So when this happens, I feel like this. When this happens, I feel like this. All right.
Right.
Well, then we'll do this one.
That's why
and
a lot
we'll
of
do that.
That's why a lot of modern therapists know that instead of like picking something like Freudianism or cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever, instead of doing that, talk to the client, Follow where the client leads. And if all else fails, you can take sort of a troubleshooting approach. So, so the person comes in and the first thing you do is say, well, is there just a practical, quick way for us to address your issues? And so you focus on what they want to change, how they want things to be, what their strengths are and things like that. You focus on that up front, practical stuff. And you'll accomplish one of two things. Either you will solve their problem like in six sessions and they'll be done. So you don't have to go into their past or anything else. Or if you don't solve it in those sessions by looking at their practical wants and needs and their strengths, you will have got gathered information about their behaviors and what behaviors they want to change. And so then you can escalate it to a behavioral perspective if you need to. Then you work on the behavioral perspective, and that one of two things will happen. Either you'll fix their problem in 13 sessions and they'll be done and you will have saved them a lot of time and effort not going into their past or whatever, or by looking at their behavior and seeing what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, and how they're able to overcome certain things or not, you will have learned a lot of things about how they think, and you can use that information to escalate to the cognitive level. Same with the cognitive level. You address their thinking, you'll either fix their problem in 24 sessions, or you will have gathered information to move on to the psychodynamic level. So, you know, that's how a troubleshooting thing works. You try the simplest thing first, and it's never a waste of time because you'll either succeed or you'll gather the information you need to move on to the next step. And you only get to that psychodynamic deep dive if they really need it. And while getting there, you will have gathered all the information you need to make that deep dive effective. And that's kind of the approach that modern therapists try to, they call it an eclectic approach or an integrated approach. But to me, it's just understanding that the client is a complex entity that can have problems on many different levels. And you're letting the client reveal to you what level that is. And you're working through those levels to get to where the solution is. And you're walking with them. You're not telling them what to do or what to think. You're walking beside them while they're moving toward their solution, going through each step. And I think that's the way a lot of therapists do it now.
And during some of those stretches where there was only one set of footprints, that was when you had to call and cancel because of a last minute schedule change. So there is our answer, people. Individually, Jung, Freud, Adler, pretty much dinosaurs don't matter anymore. As a collective supergroup, some of their later albums and B-sides in particular did give us some important insights into the modern therapeutic sound scene, as it were, and we owe them respect. If you have your own thoughts about bootleg sessions of the therapists, or, you know, cover therapists are really good. I've seen a couple of like Freud tribute acts that get a little blue, but they're incredibly useful for mental health purposes. Tell us at the blog, themagicaltalkinghead.com, or comment on the YouTube video. Go to aethertheater.com if you didn't get enough of William. Go to smashwords.com and find a book called Odd Wings and spend $3 to buy it and tell everybody you love it. That's all you need to know. Please write in themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com with whatever you want us to talk about, or whatever you want William to talk about and me to make fun of. You know, you get it. You're on my side. And I mean, I hope you all have a wonderful week. And I want to leave you with a thought I had a few days ago that is wistful and melancholy and kind of sweet, while also being kind of funny and really gross. I realized the other day that because he had passed on, and it's certainly not a conversation we ever had or would have had, never actually know if my father masturbated. I'll just never know if that was a part of his life or not.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.